Good evening and welcome. I'm Ann Ironside. I want to welcome you on behalf of the Vancouver Institute to tonight's lecture with Professor Astrom, who will be speaking on black boxes and white noise. I want to thank you for your support of the Vancouver Institute in coming out tonight and encourage you, if you have not already done so, to become members and donors of the Institute. And there is a table that you walk by on your way in. It will still be there on your way out, and we very much appreciate and need your support. So in welcoming Professor Astrom to our audience tonight, we have a shaper of the technology that has shaped our world. From the things that we've come to take for granted, like SkyTrain in Vancouver, to even the kind of conversation that we use. We use casually the words like feedback. All of this has its roots in automatic control theory, to which Dr. Astrom is a very key contributor. It's not a new idea. Professor Astrom was telling me that the Paris Opera House lighting system in 1880 was based on control theory. And Dr. Astrom in the 1950s began his work as a student at the university in Sweden and worked with IBM to develop the first guided missile. He was working for the defense industry in Sweden. He has always been a firm believer in very close links between university research and the world of the applied industrial community. He is the chair of the automatic control of the Institute of Lund, which is a department of the University of Lund. He is, his books are widely used all over the world and have been translated into Chinese and Japanese and Russian, Spanish, as well as England. He is no stranger to North America. He's taught many places in the USA, but he is a newcomer to Canada, and I think he and his wife have enjoyed a very good week and good weather. He is a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor, and we're very pleased to welcome Dr. Carl Astrom.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's really an honor for me to be able to lecture to you at this famous Vancouver Institute. And I would also like to thank you for a very nice weather that you have arranged for me and my wife during the stay that we have had here. If we could dim the lights a little bit, you will see my slides a little bit better. The topic here may sound a little strange to you. You've all heard about boxes and noise, but I'm not sure you heard about black boxes and white noise. But I will tell you a little bit about this, so by the end you leave here, these words would probably have some meaning for you. And this really has to deal with the evolution of a field called automatic control. And it's a very pervasive field, because you probably are using it, and have been using it on the way you are coming here. It's the technology that helps your cars to satisfy the emission standards. It's the technology that makes it possible for you to enjoy CD players in your home. If anybody has come here by aeroplane, it's certainly the technology that was used very crucially in that development. And what I'll try to do here is I'll try to tell you the story about how this technology developed. So here is the plan that I will follow. After a brief introduction, I will tell you a little bit about the early ideas. And you heard in here that they were used in the last century. And I will roughly start at this point, although they go back a little bit further than that. I will tell you how the discipline emerged. And if you would like to put a date on it, you could probably put around 1940. So it's a very, very young discipline. After that, I will talk about what I call the second wave, and I will come up with a couple of conclusions. So if you look at automatic control, This is a picture of a Swedish paper mill. And you had paper mills, a lot of them in Canada. And control has been very pervasive in order to make these mills run in an automatic, in an automatic fashion. It's also used to in all sorts of manufacturing, for example, to manufacture cars. Cars can also be manufactured by hand as you know it. But if you take camcorders that many of you have in your homes, they cannot be manufactured by hand, simply because the screws are too small. So that's another very useful application area. And of course, if you go into spacecrafts, they cannot function without automatic control systems. Now, how does this fit into the picture of natural science? In here, I made a slide where, where I do a little comparison of natural science and engineering science. And of course, there are very, very many differences, very many similarities between natural sciences and engineering sciences. We all rely a lot on mathematics, but there are also some fundamental differences. In natural sciences, we are trying to understand natural phenomena. In engineering sciences, we're trying to understand the technical systems that we have. In natural science, we do a lot of analysis. In engineering, there is much more emphasis on synthesis. To study natural phenomena, we have to go to a lot of isolation. We have to isolate phenomena to understand them very well. In the engineering side, instead, we have to deal with interaction and complexity. In natural science, we develop basic laws. Instead, in engineering science, we try to develop system principles. Things that allow us to deal with the complicated things like telephone systems, like electric systems, etc. And to illustrate the complexity, I would just give you one example of that. Here is, for example, what happens inside electronics. If you think here is a map of London, where many of you have been. Here is Covent Garden, here is Trafalgar Square. Suppose you make a map where you have a resolution of 50 meters, roughly a city block. In 1963, if we translate this to electrical circuits that we do today, and we make the circuit so that 1 millimeter corresponds to 1 kilometer of the city block, then we have 50 mu, that is microns, sitting here. So we can do circuits with a resolution corresponding to this in 1963. In 78, we could cover the whole of Greater London with the same resolution. And today, we can cover a better part of Europe. There you see England, and there you see part of Sweden, and incidentally, that's where Lund is. So that's a little illustration of the sort of complexity we have to deal with in engineering systems. Now let's move on to the control field and look a little bit about the early ideas. And one of the first ideas I will talk about are what I call early process control. Windmills started to be used in the 1700s, and there was some very interesting automation done in the early windmills. One wanted the windmills to point into the wind. We wanted to have them to grind at constant speed. And a device that was called the centrifugal governor, which I've shown in here, was actually used in windmills. Later on, it was picked up by James Watt and his collaborators to make sure that steam engines would be running at constant speed. And when water turbines came around, they were using a very similar ideas to that. So that's a very old example. In connection with this, one came upon some very interesting phenomena. And I illustrate them here with a situation on spinners. So, for example, if you are connecting more load in a factory where you have spinners and weaving machine, and if you are losing some of the weaving machine, then the velocity will increase like this. And, of course, that's very undesirable because you may get thread breaks and other things. And then by having the centrifugal governors, and if we increase the gain of this by changing the mechanism, we could decrease the error. But if we increase the gain too much, you get an oscillation. So you had to do a match-up between a reaction of these disturbances so that the velocity doesn't change too much and so it doesn't oscillate. And this was one of the first cases one came across the compromise of accuracy and stability. Incidentally, these controllers are called PID controllers. Mathematically, they are given by this form here. U is proportional to an error, an integral of the error, and the rate of change of the error. And in the beginning of this century, there were many industries developed. Here you recognize several names like Honeywell, etc., that were built upon the idea of doing simple controllers of this type. I will move on to a different field, flight control. The Wright brothers started to make aeroplanes in 1905. And of course, there were many attempts before the Wright brothers. And you may ask yourself, why did the Wright brothers succeed? Well, the people before them had been trying to do stable aircrafts. That is, aircrafts that when they come up to the wind, they were flying very stably. The problem with this was that they could, it was difficult to get them off the ground. And if the wind changed so they dropped, there was no way to get them to raise up quickly. And what the Wright brothers did was that they made an aeroplane that was unstable. They put the rudder up front, so when they changed the rudder, they could very quickly get the aeroplane to rise above the ground. But by doing this, they had, of course, put a lot of load on the pilot. And that was a strong stimulation to do autopilots. And actually, the first autopilot was developed by Sperry in 1912. In here, I have a reproduction of an old photograph. And this was taken from a competition on safe aircrafts in France. And the Sperry son was sitting here and flying the aircraft. A pilot was walking along the wing. And the pilot was waving with his hands. He said, "Look here, I don't have to touch the sticks to control the aeroplane." And they also say in the note, notice the proximity to the ground. The ground is sitting up here. So already in 1912, we had autopilots for aircrafts. Here is a couple of other facts. Of course, there was a fully automatic flight across the Atlantic, including takeoff and landing, that was done already in 1947 with military aircraft. And a natural continuation of this, of course, are the spacecraft. I will move to another field, telecommunications. When Bell had invented the telephone, one started to pull telephone lines over longer and longer distances. And the first transcontinental cable was put up in 1914. And then you needed to have amplifiers that were amplifying the voltages because you get voltage drops in the copper wires. And in here, you can see that as the years go by, you get more and more amplifiers that you needed to have in the long-distance communications. Here you had 3 to 6. Here you had about 20. Around 1938, you had 40. And in 1940, you had about 600. It was very difficult to make electric amplifiers that you can connect many of them after each other because you got distortion. And it was only after making an invention, and that was the invention of the feedback amplifier, that it was possible to make the long-distance telephones to work. And the idea with a feedback amplifier, you take a little bit of the output voltage, and then you feed it back into the input. And there was an engineer at AT&T, now called Bell Labs, who invented this in 1928. And that was one of the first times the word feedback appears in a patent application. People didn't believe this, so it took 8 years in the patent office before they granted the patent. In connection with this, they again had the problem of instabilities. The electronics engineers at the time called that singing. They said the amplifiers were singing. And you, of course, are all familiar with that. When you take a microphone here, you're talking, and you get feedback from the microphone to the speakers, you get a squeaking sound that you're all familiar with. So they saw the same phenomenon that people have seen when they were controlling steam engines. So that was a little bit about the early history. And of course, In 1935, nobody realized the connections between industrial process control, flight control systems, and telephone connections. Although in retrospect it was exactly the same idea. It took a very sad event, the war, for these ideas to come together. So under the pressures of the war, what happened in many countries, United States, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain, one had the belief that technology could help the war effort. And for example, in the United States, there was a National Defense Research Committee who channeled scientific talents to tackle the war problems. So for example, at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one set up radiation laboratory, servo mechanist laboratory, instrument laboratory, etc. And one brought people with wide backgrounds together to help the war effort, to do radar, to do gun sights, and to do flight control systems. When this happened, people discovered that they were actually had been dealing with very similar problems in very diverse disciplines. So the things I mentioned before, industrial process control, telecommunications, flight control, and mathematics came together. And we can say that the field of automatic control emerged. One discovered a number of principles. The theory was developed. A design methodology to design control systems were developed. And a number of applications in the military arena were done. One of the important things that came up was the idea of the black box. And this was one way to deal with complexity. If you looked at, for example, the radar systems, there was a mix of very different technologies. There were pumps that were driving hydraulics. There were electrical measurements. There were mechanical links. And then people came up with the idea to describe those systems. You sort of say covered the interior of the system, no matter what it is. And you treat them as something where you can send in a signal. And as a result of this, it will respond and send out other signals. And that was the idea of the black box. One can view a complicated system as connected of boxes like this, and no matter what was inside in here, it was something that was transforming a signal of some type coming in and giving rise to another signal. And in this way, one obtained a unified way of dealing with electric system, hydraulic system, mechanical systems, and aeroplanes. Now to describe the internal things that went on in a black box. How could we do this? Well, what you would like to do is that no matter what signal you present to the input here, you would like to be able to predict what's going to happen at the output. So here I've given a couple of examples. You suddenly increase the input, and maybe the output would behave like this. You give it a little kick like this, and you see what happens. Well, it turns out that in many cases, the system are what you call linear. If you make the input twice as big, the output will be twice as big. And also, it's time invariant, so it doesn't matter really where you are applying this input to it. It will behave the same way. And it turns out that for linear system, one could make a fantastic simplification. It is enough to know how the system will respond to a little pulse like this. It's also enough to know how it will respond to periodic signals, sinusoids. If you know how it responds to all possible periodic signals, we know exactly how the system behaves. And that was one of the big inventions to discover to deal with linear systems of this type. Some other things that emerged during this time was two ideas of building up systems. One is what's called feed forward, if you will, planning an open loop. If here is a process we're going to try to control, and if it doesn't behave in the right way, then we can connect the box in front of it here, and I send in a signal here, and the combination of those two will behave as I plan to do them. That was the idea of feed forward. The other idea of feedback, which I mentioned in connection with telephones, is the following. In here is the desired response of the system. Then I compare the way how the system is responding. I take the difference. I send it through a little box in here. And then I make a correction in this way. So all the time, I'm comparing the actual response with the response I would like to have it here. One could combine this in a very sensible way, and that's shown in this diagram in here. Here I show a model which gives our desired behaviors. If I shake something in here, this is really the way I would like it to behave in. And then I have a feedback system in here, so I compare the actual behavior with the desired behavior. If there is a mistake, I do a correction. The drawback with feedback is that you must get an error in here in order to do a correction. And in particular, if systems are slow, it's very good to combine it with feedback. So in here, you kick the system in the right direction first, and if this is working very well, you get very small errors. You don't have to do much corrections. But if there's a deviation, the feedback action goes into place. So there were two very important ideas coming up at the time, the feedback and the feedforward. If you look at the theory, mathematically it was based on theory of complex variables and Laplace transforms. The system concepts I mentioned here are feedback and feedforward. And the way to design systems were essentially graphical. And to experiment with the system, one was using a device called analog computers, where you were simulating the behavior of the system using electronic devices. And one also used small analog computers to build the feedback box and the feedforward box in the system. As a result of this, there were a number of things. Around 1945, when we got peace, most of the results that were developed were put up in the public domain. Also, one had noticed that these tools and tricks that were learned during the war could be very useful for peaceful purposes. So there was, over the world, spread an education wave. So the field of automatic control started to be taught in engineering schools all over the world. There were a large number of applications that was spreading very rapidly over the different fields. One started to get international organizations. In the turmoil after the World War, the control engineers got together at a fairly early stage and created the International Federation of Automatic Control, where one really tried to get all countries to talk together, and one was very successful in doing this. Journals appeared, and international conferences were organized. So you can say around 1945, we had this field automatic control. A large number of textbooks started to come out, and it was put into the engineering curriculum. Now, something very interesting happened. This by itself had a significant influence on engineering, and you can say that automatic control was one of the first system subjects that were taught. You know, in engineering, we talk about electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, chemical engineering. This was a classification that fitted very well to the situation we had in the end of last century and the beginning of this century. If you look to the problems we have today, it's not at all very clear that we can separate it like this. To solve many engineering problems, you need to know mechanical engineering, you need to know electrical engineering. So these fields that are today called systems started to emerge, and automatic control was one of the first system areas. Now, something that was very interesting for the field was that it didn't stop here. We got what I call the second wave. So around 1955, when the field of automatic control was fairly well established, there were new forces coming into action. The ideas were applied to a very large variety of fields, and there were interesting signals coming back from these applications. For example, servo mechanism theory only deals with a situation where we have one single measurement. Very often you have many measurements that you have to measure. It only dealt with a situation that you essentially have one variable that you can manipulate. Well, with the system we had, there were needs to manipulate many things at the same time. There were also some new challenging problems, primarily in the space race. You know, both the Americans and the Soviet Union were trying to put up rockets into the space. They both started with German technology, and they brought the German scientists over to both camps, and they realized the military and political significance of this. And many new things were needed to deal with the space problems. A new technology was coming around. We got computers. When I went to school, there was only one computer in the whole of Sweden. And people thought that this computer could solve all computer problems we would have in Sweden for the next 10 years, for example. And you now know what it looks like. There are often several computers in the homes. In many new cars, there are about 10, 20 computers sitting there. And as a result of this, there were also a lot of good people working in the area, so there were a number of new ideas that were emerging. Let's look at some of them. The key elements that happened was that, number one, one got a re-examination of the fundamental ideas. There was a very vital interaction with other disciplines, and then one developed theory to match the new technology. And one coined a name that I think is very bad. You call it modern control theory. And to give you some ideas of this, I will have here list up a couple of names. Optimal control, talk a little bit about that. Computer control, the idea that we could use the digital computer to control machines, to control factories. I will not speak very much in detail about computer control later on, so let me just mention this. And we got a whole collection of names like stochastic control that I will talk a little bit about. I will also talk a little bit about adaptive control later on. So I got new problems to look at with new solutions. One important thing that happened was that one re-examined the basic way of looking at dynamical systems. I mentioned before the black box view, where we viewed the box as being something. We didn't care about the input. If I just could describe what happened when I sent in a signal here, how it would react. For example, how an aeroplane would react when I'm changing the rudder. That was something that was primarily coming from electrical engineering, from the telecommunications engineers at Bell Labs, for example. Well, in mechanical engineering, one takes a very different attitude. There, one does internal description. We describe in detail how this mechanism is working internally. And a very important concept in that context is the notion of state. The state of a system is the information, the smallest information you need to know about the past history in order to predict the future. Of course, that's a very useful idea, because if we are controlling something, we are very often interested in predicting how will it behave in the future. And then instead of keeping track of everything that's happened, if we just could keep track of the state, we have enough information that we need to predict. So there was a new theory developed that was more or less leaning much more on mechanical engineering than on electrical engineering. And for those of you who are dealing with mathematics, one was using ordinary differential equation, and as a side effect, we were also able to deal a little bit with nonlinearities. I mentioned optimal control before, and here was a typical problem. We had a rocket, and we would like to send up a rocket so it goes into a orbit around the Earth. And what was very much concerned in North America was the fact that the American rockets were much weaker than the Russian rockets. So they had to be much more clever in the way they were. You see, what you would like to do is that you don't want to burn off all your fuel when you are way down, because then you have a lot of friction in the atmosphere. On the other hand, it's good to accelerate early, because then you can make use of the whole velocity increase that you have. So it's quite a delicate problem to know. How quickly should you burn off the fuel when you shoot off the rocket in here? And of course, an interesting problem was, is there a best way to manage this business of shooting up the rockets so that I can get up the largest possible payload with it? It turns out that this is a very old type of mathematics that was done by Euler, I'm sorry for a misspelling in here, and Lagrange. And there was a mathematical theory that's called calculus of variation that was, in a certain sense, perfected in Chicago around 1935. Well, it turned out that this optimal control problem looked like calculus of variations problem, but mathematically they were a bit different. And typically the difference was that if you control a rocket, you have a maximum thrust and you have a minimum thrust. You can have full blast and you can have nothing and you can have everything in between. And there was some very interesting extensions of this done by a Russian researcher named Pondryagin. He was a mathematician who got the Lenin Prize for this. And there was another line of research that goes back to Hamilton and Jacobi, and an American researcher called Bellman, who invented something called dynamic programming. So this led to a re-examination of a very classical field, and it gave some very useful practical results. I mentioned in my introduction something called white noise, and I will talk a little bit about this. If we are going to control something, you could, for example, visualize we are going to try to control an aircraft that's flying. When you are sitting there, you often get a sign from the pilot telling you that now you have to fasten your seat belts because we are encountering turbulence. Now, if you control an aeroplane, it's quite important that you know the character of the turbulence, how the plane is wiggling. The same thing if you're going to steer a boat. You have to act very, very differently when you have waves, and depending on the wave patterns, you also have to counteract this. So if we're going to control system well, it's very useful for us to be able to characterize disturbances. And here I've drawn a very typical disturbance situation. There are many ideas we can use. One idea, if we look at this disturbance here as a signal, is that I can create a little filter that's picking up frequencies of this disturbance between a certain frequency range. You can think about a disturbance as being some kind of sound. And then we say, well, to describe this, let's ask, how much energy do I have between 400 hertz and 440 hertz? How much energy do I have between 440 hertz and 500 hertz, etc.? So you try to split it up to say, roughly, how quickly is this disturbance varying? Well, this is something that's called power spectrum. Now, white noise, that's a signal which has as much energy in all frequencies. If you want to hear what it sounds, it sounds like this sort of washing sounds you have from the sea. It's very typical like white noise. A very nice aspect of white noise is that if we have any other sort of noise, I can always describe this by putting in white noise into a filter. So from a theoretical point of view, the only new thing I have to introduce is the white noise, and then I can obtain all other disturbances in here by simply using a filter here in the black box point of view. Now that meant a fantastic simplification to the people who were developing theory. One could really simplify the way we were dealing with disturbances. And this led to something that we are calling stochastic control theory. If you would like to have an everyday name for it, you can call it decision making under uncertainty. How should we do actions when we have disturbances of all types that are influencing us? It was, again, a very interesting mathematical development. There was, again, a famous Russian, Kolmogorov, who developed a theory for it. There was an American called Norbert Wiener, who many of you have heard as the creator of cybernetics. They developed a theory for filtering and prediction of disturbances of this type. And by combining this with the calculus of variation, one obtained a theory that tells us how we should control systems when we are subject to disturbances of this type. And there were some interesting principles that were coming up in this context. There was an economist, Herbert Simon, who got the Nobel Prize some 10 years ago. He coined an idea that he called certain equivalence principle. And it said something like this: if you are going to make decisions or control in an uncertain environment, you should make the best possible estimate of what the unknown factors are, and then you should act as if they were true. This is not a bad heuristic idea, but it's not the best thing you could do. The best thing you could do is instead called dual control. And one way to formulate this is to say that control should be investigating as well as directing. What this means that if you have to make decision in a situation where there are uncertainties, you can make decisions that drive you to the right goal, but you should also do actions that will give you more information. So for example, if I'm trying to steer a ship when there is uncertainty, I would try to steer the ship in the right direction. But it will actually pay off to deviate a little bit so that I get better information about what's happening. So that was an interesting principle that came out of this idea about dual control. After all this abstract thing, I will now go really back to Earth, and I'll take an example that you have a lot of here in Canadian industry. Namely, to make paper out of wood. Now, when you're doing this, you would like, you see, here is a simple sketch of a paper machine. The paper is coming out in this end, and here you have the wood that you're mixing up with water, and you're passing through all sorts of processing in here. The important thing is that here's a valve where you're adjusting the amount of pulp that you are feeding into this paper machine, and out here you get the thickness. To control this, we would like to know, for example, how will the thickness be influenced when I change this valve? We can obtain this information by doing experiments. We shake the valves up and down like this, and we simply record what the thickness is in here. By analyzing these two signals here, we can figure out how this paper machine behaves for the purpose of controlling. We can also figure out what is the nature of the fluctuation sitting in. And then this stochastic control theory would tell us, if I'm measuring in here and I'm seeing that the weight is wrong, what data processing should I make on this signal in here in order to change the position of the valve sitting there? So that's a very practical application of this theory. And here I've given you an example. Here I showed you time, and I can show how the thickness of the paper will fluctuate under normal circumstances. If you are using the ideas that I told you about, you can instead get this thickness variation of the paper. And you see it's much less variation in here than we have up here. And down here, you see how the valve moves. And the scales are the same, so that this would more or less tell you the fluctuations that the control system that's adjusting the valve is taking care of. Here we are making an intentional perturbation to see how it works. That's the reason for this peak. So this, if you can say, is a very practical use of the ideas of stochastic control. Here I will tell you about another idea of doing control systems. And again, it's control systems that are a little bit smarter than they were previously. Here is a process we are interested in controlling. We can again think it's this paper machine we were dealing with. And here, this U represents the valve that we're opening. This Y represents the thickness of the paper. Now, this control system does the following. It sees how this valve is changing. And it sees how the thickness of the paper is varying. When it knows these two variations over time, the system will develop by itself a model of how this machine behaves. And it will also develop a model of how the fluctuations are going. When it knows the model in here, it can calculate ways to control the system. And it can adjust parameters of a controller that's sitting here. So we can say that instead of doing an engineering work where an engineer does a mathematical model and an engineer does design of a control system, here we have a box that's carrying out all the things. It does engineering work automatically, so to say. And I will give you an example of use of this that I've been quite a lot concerned with myself. It has to do with doing autopilots for tankers like this. This is an oil tanker. It's about 350 meters in this direction, and it's about 90 meters in this direction. To get a perspective on the dimension, I used to say in the United States, you can put 5 football fields on it. So it's a fairly big ship. Now, if we are going to control a ship, we should do very differently depending what the wave motion is. If you have, and the waves are really the major things that will make the ship deviate from its desired path. Now, if we are doing a controller, an adaptive controller of the type I illustrated with, on the next slide I show you some differences of behavior. This here represents a conventional autopilot. It's more or less a PID controller of the type that James Watts was using for his steam mills. And in here we can see the deviations in heading. Fluctuates. And this is 4 degrees up and down. So up there is 4 degrees. Down here is what the rudder does. This represents a fairly bad weather, so there are fairly large variations. If we provide this tanker with an adaptive autopilot, then we are getting these variations instead. You know, significantly smaller fluctuations in heading than we have up here. And you see here the rudder motion. It's not unlike the rudder motion we have there, but we get a significant reduction in this. We can translate this, for example, to savings in oil, and it turns out that this controller here uses 4% less oil than this controller sitting here. The reason why this can do so much better is that this controller actually develops in itself a model of the waves, and it counteracts the waves. So in a certain sense, it's much more complicated than this one. Hence, it should also do better. So this is an example, again, a very practical example, how some of these ideas I mentioned can be put into good real use. I mentioned before that control has very many application areas. It is used very widely in energy generation. In all nuclear power plants, in conventional power plants, we will find a lot of control systems built into it. The same for electricity transmission. When you are transmitting electricity over long distances, there are control systems coming in many, many of these places. Process control is another situation. If you take a typical paper mill, you will have many thousands of control loops sitting in a conventional paper mill. If you take discrete manufacturing, that is manufacturing of cars and machines, there's a lot of automatic control going into this. Instrumentation is another very interesting area. There was a very drastic change in instrumentation in the 50s and 60s, where when we were starting to introduce feedback into the instrumentation system, and we started to get new generations of instrumentation systems. I mentioned before telecommunications. In all the telecommunication systems we have today, there's a fantastic amount of feedback. The long-distance telephone communication wires could not have been done if one had not implemented the feedback amplifier. And of course, in today's system where you have, for example, cellular telephones, you know, you are driving in your car, you have this cellular telephone, there's a little radio station picking this off. When the signal gets too weak from one station, you automatically switch over to another station. So in there, you have an extremely complicated control system to deal with this. You have a lot of applications of control in transportation. You have it more and more in your cars. And you all know that there was a drastic change in the attitude to cars in California some 10 years ago, where they introduced very heavy measures on emission. These requirements could not have been satisfied if one had not been introducing control systems in the engines of the cars that are running the engines in such a way so that the emissions of bad substances are not too large. Nowadays, it's also coming in many other cases. For example, in ABS system, automatic braking systems. I guess you have slippery roads in Canada like we have in Sweden, so when you drive in the wintertime, you easily get into skids. Now you have control systems that is have sensors so they are feeling the skip on the wheels, and then they are adjusting the things automatically. There's a lot of control in aircrafts, which I will come into much more later. We have it in heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. This is unfortunately one of our bad areas, because many of these systems are not very well designed. The reason for this is that partly economical and partly the building codes. We worked on this for a long time in Sweden, and we tried to influence the building codes so that we would have sensible ways of testing the air conditioning and heating systems, but that was not accepted. Amazingly, there's a lot of control in entertainment. We heard in the introduction in here that in the Paris Opera, they were using, before Edison, they were using lights with sparks. So you had carbon electrodes and then you had sparks. And you need to adjust the carbon closer and closer together as it burns. So that was a very early application of feedback. If you look to the CD players that you have in your homes today, there are some very delicate control systems in them who make sure that you can the little laser can follow the track very accurately. And there is another feedback system that adjusts the focusing of the laser light. So, you know, when you need a precision of about a few mu, a few millions of a meter to track it correctly. And you know, when you're inserting the CD disc into your player, you will never insert it so accurate. So you need a control system to follow this all the time. And of course, if you look to VCR systems, if you look to camcorders, there are a lot of feedback built into them. And not the least the cameras. You know, you have cameras with automatic focusing. You have cameras with where you automatically adjust the shutters. So there's a lot of feedback all around you. You also have a lot of feedback and control system into physics. Many of the apparatus that are built in physics laboratory and instruments, they are relying on feedback for their proper function. You are all walking around with some rather fantastic control systems. For example, I can stand upright here. And that's because of a control system that is able to keep me standing upright, even if I'm closing my eyes, and even if I'm skiing. Of course, if I'm skiing, sometimes the feedback system doesn't quite cope with the disturbances that's coming to it. You have nice temperature control systems. You can sit in a sauna, and then you can jump into ice-cold water, and still not too many bad things happening to your body. You can sit in a dark room, and you go outside in the sunlight, and immediately there will be feedback system that will close your eyes so that you don't get too many photons coming in and spoiling your eye. People have been trying to apply control system to economics. I will not go too deeply into that, but I cannot resist to make at least one example. Here is we'll leave this economic example a little bit later, but let me talk about some applications where I call, say, control is mission critical. In other words, this system could not be made to function if we did not have feedback. That's clearly the case in flight control and in space flight. In some of the automotive systems I mentioned before, we cannot satisfy the emissions. Here I gave you a picture of the CD player. You see, here's a little control system. There's a laser here that looks at the disc. And here is a magnet. And on this magnet, there's a little coil that moves this arm around like this. So that's how you are moving it across the disc. And then in here, there's a focusing mechanism. So there's two control systems sitting there. I mentioned before camcorder manufacturing, which can only be done by robots. I will give one example where control is mission critical. And that has to do with aircrafts. And in aircrafts, in the old time, they were built like this. You built an aircraft like this, and then the engineers were coming and putting the autopilots into them. And that was actually the origin of the word black box. The engineers were coming with their black boxes, they were connecting them to the aircrafts, and then you had the autopilot sitting there. Well, that is something you can call the first phase of control. You take a system that's sitting there, and then you introduce automation later on. Of course, a much more interesting way of doing this is to say, well, now when we have feedback systems and control systems, can we now start to make more efficient or better system by incorporating them directly into the aircraft? And that's precisely what is happening in the aircraft industry. So when you design aircraft, you have aerodynamicists who are looking into the aerodynamics. You have strength of materials people who look into the, make sure that the plane will hold up to the strength. And then you put in control engineers who are looking into the control systems. And now when you mix these together, you can do some interesting things. And I've illustrated this with these two pictures that we will talk about for a while. In here, I show a simple picture of an aircraft. And here's the center of mass. And for an ordinary aircraft, here is where the center of pressure would be. So you can reduce all pressures acting on the aircraft as a single force that acts here. And here is where center of mass is. Now, this airplane would be stable because it has the center of pressure behind the center of mass. This would be a typical situation when you fly subsonic. If you fly supersonic, because of the physics, this point will move further back. So this distance from being about, say, 1 decimeter or 2 here will go up to about 1 meter. Now, if you do this, you will get an aircraft that is extremely stable. It would be like having an arrow with a very, very big fin on it. So it will go straight forward. And to make it turn, you need to have some very big rudders in the end of the airplane. Because you have such a big distance between these two forces, so it really would like to go straight forward. Of course, this has several drawbacks, because when you have the big rudder, you need to have a lot of strength in here to withstand the force. So then suppose we do like this instead. We redesign the aircraft so that the center of pressure is sitting forward of the center of mass. This would be like throwing an arrow backwards. Then the airplane is unstable. But when we go supersonic, then this point will move forward in this direction. And the maximum distance between the center of mass and the center of pressure would be not at all be so big. As a result of this, you need much smaller rudder area sitting in here, and you can make the airplane much weaker. If you calculate how it comes out, it turns out that this airplane will weigh about 30% less than this one for the same equivalent performance. This is, of course, very attractive, in particular to people who are doing military aircraft. There is, however, a snag. This airplane here will not be stable by itself. It will require automatic controls to keep it stable, because a pilot cannot stabilize an aircraft like this. Incidentally, the Wright brothers' airplane had a little bit of this. But this was such a slow airplane, so it was possible to cope with it for a person. If you look at the modern fighter airplanes, they will not have this problem. So they rely on control system to make them stable in certain flight conditions. These flight conditions happen to be takeoff and landing. So in here you see that you can get some benefits by using control system. On the other hand, you also put a tremendous responsibility of the control system. Because now the control system will be something that is absolutely necessary for this system to work. I mentioned here economics. When you think about control, you can also think about the ideas that you would like to control, for example, an economy. And that is something that many people have ventured into. One of the first was a British control theorist called Tustin, who wrote a book about this some 30 years ago. Here I've taken an excerpt from the British Parliament. They had a committee on policy optimization, and they published a little booklet on this in 1978. And they were asked to consider the present state of development of optimal control technique as applied to macroeconomic policy, to make recommendations concerning the feasibility and value of applying these techniques within Her Majesty's Treasury. And there is quite a lot of research that is going on where one is trying to apply this kind of control ideas to economics. There is also quite a substantial effort within econometrics to make mathematical models of various types of the economies that can be used for control. I mentioned before biology. And here I've taken a book out of a textbook of medicine. And what one has tried to do in here is to map on the surface of the brain the different functions. And you can see in here some interesting things. Here you have the thumb, the index finger, the middle finger. But what you see in here, there is quite a bit of brain surface that one believes is dedicated to organize the hand motion. There is also quite a bit of the brain surface that is used for the leg motion. And that's a fantastically challenging problem to figure out how this system here really works. It's clear that there is a fantastic amount of feedback going around. And there have been many studies done both on simple mechanism and on complicated mechanism. And for example, if you look at a locust leg, there are something like 2,000 sensors in the locust leg that is sending up signals to the locust to help it to move the leg in the right connection. So that's clearly an example of a very, very complicated feedback system that we do not know very much about. So now let's try to wrap up a little bit about what I've said. I had an introduction where I tried to tell you a little bit that there is control systems all around you, although you may not have thought about this. There's feedback going around in your houses, in your cars, in the vehicles, etc. I told you how the early ideas were, then they came up in many different fields, and I mentioned three of them. I mentioned industrial process control, and for example, what James Watt did with his steam engines. I mentioned early flight control. I mentioned telecommunications. And what is fascinating, that all these three different fields, underlying them are the same basic ideas, the same basic phenomena. In all these systems, you can easily get into oscillations. You can treat them with very much similar mathematical results, etc. Now, this was discovered around 1940, during the war pressures, where the discipline of feedback control emerged. I also spent quite a lot of time talking about what I call the second wave. So it's quite an interesting field, because here you have the field established, and very, very shortly afterwards, you get new ideas, you get new technology, and other things coming into this. And that's what I was describing in here. So, what kind of conclusions can we now draw? Well, what I try to do is I try to give you a glimpse of what I call an emerging field. Many fields that we deal with are much older. You know, if you look at mathematics, if you look at physics, they are much older than what a field like automatic control is. On the other hand, automatic control is pervasive in the sense that it appears as an essential ingredient in many of the engineering systems we have around us, either for utility, for entertainment, etc. I mentioned a couple of system principles. I mentioned feedback. I mentioned feed forward. I mentioned the dual control idea, that if you are in an uncertain situation, you are not only trying to steer exactly where you would like to do, you also do a little bit of wiggling to get better information. I think you may all actually have done this when you start driving your car in the morning when you're afraid there's a little bit of ice on the road. You brake a little bit to feel if the car is slipping. You steer around a little bit to see how the car feels. And then you decide if you're going to be the ordinary reckless driver or if you're going to take it a little bit more easy. So you all have used dual control in a sense. I think we have many challenges ahead of us. And I will elaborate a little bit on those. I think like in all fields, there is what you can call a gap between theory and practice. It took at least 70 years before one discovered that there were strong similarities between industrial process control, telecommunications, and autopilots. And the way this was discovered was by doing abstractions, by doing mathematics. Now, if you abstract too much, it becomes difficult to connect to the real world. And that's something we are seeing in conferences, we are seeing in meetings, that this is something we always have to keep in our minds. I wrote here another challenge we have. That is a challenge to make what is nowadays called intelligent systems. Systems that are easy in one way to deal with. And that very much has to do with what I call man-machine interfaces. And we have seen very many bad uses of automation. For example, when we're automating factories. All over the world, it's quite common today that we put computers into things like paper mills, chemical processing plants, etc. And what we typically have been doing is that we've been automating those things that are easy to automate. And then we've been leaving the rest of the task to the human beings. And very often you find, before, you used to have instrument engineers that were walking around with the plants, they were looking at the valves, they were looking at what happens. And now we introduce centralized control rooms. We bring all this information into the control rooms, and we have instruments there that are seeing what's happening. We let the computers send out signals to the valves and to the motors. And then we have big TV screens which the operators are looking at. And normally, the operators have nothing to do. If something goes wrong, we expect these operators to perform superhuman tasks. Now suddenly, they have to have a global view of everything that goes on in these plants, and they have to act and do the right things. And that's, of course, in some times an impossible situation. You can all think about Three Mile Island, for example, where something goes wrong with a nuclear reactor, and the operators have to take some actions. It was on the night shift. They didn't have the right information, and nothing had been happening for a long time, so they were not tuned with this. So in here, I think we have a lot of things that we can do very, very much better. I've written here also technology-society interface. Of course, one serious drawback with automation is that it takes away jobs. It takes away some jobs that maybe are not so interesting to have, but it certainly takes away jobs. It creates other jobs. But whenever we have changes of that nature, we know that there will always be all sorts of unpleasant things happening in society. If you look at Sweden, for example, in the beginning of this century, I think about more than 90% of us was concerned with farming. Now it's only 4% of us who do farming. And that's been a tremendous change. And of course, now when we are using technology to automate works, we certainly have problems to think about. I wrote also down here what I call academic positioning. If you take all this systems field where automatic control is one, there are other ones like information theory, etc. It's not at all clear how we should introduce them when we're teaching our engineers. If you look at the engineering curriculum today, and when I went to school, today there are many, many more subjects that we have our engineers to do. And we have not got rid of the old stuff. And it cannot go on like this, because then we will use the whole lifetime of the people to educate them. So somehow we must find a way to change the way we are teaching so that we can accommodate the growing knowledge in a sensible way. And if you take the field of automatic control, there's big confusion how to do this. In some schools, you have you teach control in mechanical engineering. You have other groups teaching it in electrical engineering and in chemical engineering. In some places, like we do in Lund, we have one group that's teaching control to everybody. And I don't think at all we have the right answers to this. So I think this illustrates the fact that feedback control is certainly a very interesting, fascinating area. But it's not easy to see how we should cope with this in the wide sense. And I think this is a good way to stop. Thank you very much.
Questions? There's one up there.
Yes. Could you please state, I don't know what the, do you state your names before you ask, and step forward here and use the microphone.
And usually, as the speaker, you repeat the question.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Hello, I'm Colin Clark. You remember me?
I remember you very well.
I found your talk fascinating. I wanted to raise the question of the economic system a little bit. I think it was a philosopher, perhaps Barrett, his name was, who pointed out that we have these fantastic control systems. Technology is unbelievably complicated and works to a degree that we never could have imagined, on one hand. On the other hand, we have our economic systems that are in a state of, well, nearly collapse. If we think of Canada, we have deficits out of control, unemployment out of control, economic systems collapsing throughout the country, fisheries on the East Coast vanished overnight. The list goes on and on. And he points out that there must be something wrong with our technological system if, on the one hand, we have these sensationally brilliant inventions of these technological systems, and on the other hand, we simply can't control our economic systems. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, let me repeat. That was Colin Clark, and he has been using mathematics in a very clever way to see how you should manage fisheries. So I think that's an interesting application. But coming back to economics, well, I think technical systems, no matter how complicated they are comparatively simple compared to, for example, biological systems and economical systems. So I think it's a much more difficult task to try to control an economic system. But I also believe that when we look to technical systems and engineering systems, we have developed a methodology that I think is useful and that something of this could be learned a little bit. And I think one thing is that we don't make big changes in the technical systems unless we are reasonably reassured that things are going to work well for us. You know, you do simulations, you do little calculations, you make a pilot plant, you make a slightly bigger plant. Now, in my experience, if you look at the political establishment, I hope we have some politicians here who can fight me back, but I think you have a tendency to make very drastic changes without thinking through many of the consequences of these changes. And I don't think you do this because you are bad, because I think that you are very eager to do things better for us. So I don't think it's at all done in bad will. And I think it very often happens that you have a system that is not working very well. We see this often in university. There are some things that are not working well. And then you introduce a new mechanism. So there's this part that did not work well before. It will work better under the new scheme. But you forget that there were some things that were working very well under the old scheme, and that will be working much worse under the new scheme. And so my view is that I have a great respect, let's say, for non-technical systems, because I think they are much more complicated than the simple technical systems we deal with. And therefore, I've tried several times applying control theory to economics, for example, and the models don't work so well at all. You can get them to work a little bit for a while, but in the long run, it's very, very difficult to make the models work well. And also, you have lots of people involved in the system. And then you introduce, for example, taxation schemes that would work very well if people would act the same way under the new taxation scheme as under the old taxation scheme. Well, when you change the rules, people change and work in different ways. So then the meshes don't work so better. So these are a few comments. I don't know if you are satisfied or...
Professor Clark?
Yes. I think that if we are, you were saying in the lower schools, or in, let me take the universities first. I personally think that I can speak with reasonable confidence about engineering education. And I think it makes a lot of sense to introduce some of what I call, say, the systems-oriented topics at a fairly early stage in the engineering curriculum. You can't introduce it too early because you need to have some specific examples to hang it on. In our school system, for example, we introduce it in the beginning of the third year. I think that's a fairly good way to start to introduce the system concepts. I think it's important when we do this that we not only talk about the theoretical aspect, but that we also tie the theoretical aspect to some practical application. Because then students get a feel for that these are theories, they have limitations, they have restrictions, and then you have a real world out there, and you cannot match all the properties of the real world system. I personally think that it would make a lot of sense to introduce a little bit more mathematics into the economics curriculum. But then, you know, I'm really outside my own field of expertise. When it comes to the introductory school system, I don't really have much to say about that. I don't know if you would like to follow up with additional questions or...
No, I don't feel I should take up people's time.
Okay. Okay. Let me clarify. The question was that there are many people that came to mind. Jacquard with his loom was one, and Moog in particular was the other one. Are you thinking about the Moog with the hydraulic valves? I'm terribly sorry, but I'm personally not very familiar with Moog's invention. I should also mention in here that there are many, many names that I have not mentioned. I said in the end that I was giving you a glimpse of an old field, and that's certainly what I've been doing. I'm very sorry, but I cannot say anything sensible about Moog.
Question?
Yes. I personally not had this, but I have a colleague in Norway, Professor Jens Balken,
who has been doing some very interesting experiments with fish. You know, Norway is a country that, like Canada, depends quite a lot upon fishing. And he has some quite innovative ideas. And one of his ideas is that the idea to go fishing by, so to say, randomly searching out fish is not so very smart. So therefore, he puts electrodes into his fishes. And then he puts this on some leading fishes. And he's trying to steer fishing shoals so he can bring them to feeding grounds. And when the Russian fishing fleet is coming, he can bring them into the Norwegian fjords again. I should also mention that when you come into simpler animals, there's been some very interesting studies done of, say, the neurons of extremely simple animals, like maneterbia, what's that in English? Jellyfish, yes. The question was, what limitations do I see in control of humidity and ventilation? My own view of that is that the most severe limitation are the building codes. And I can tell you why. When I became a professor in London in 1965, we did some very serious research projects into heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. And we were doing experiments out in actual buildings, and we could show that it was possible to do much better systems that were currently around. And the reason why we started to look into the reasons why this did not occur. And then I discovered some interesting things. The way you do delivery inspection of heating ventilation system in Sweden at the time is that you look to the boxes that were supposed to be delivered. You check the number of the boxes to see that they agree with the specifications. You never check the connections with the boxes, and you never check the performance. We had suggested to the building code people that they would do the following. In a building like this, to test it, I would bring in my own sensors that are calibrated. And then I would ask the people, well, set the temperature in this building to 25 centigrades. And then I would read off my own sensors, and I would say, well, what do my own sensors show? And then we would ask them, now lower the temperature to 22, and we will make a record of how the temperature in the building is actually going down with my own sensors. Now, if you would introduce a code like this, that would be very easy to figure out if the systems are working. Well, in the current building codes, still they don't have requirements like this. So people are only buying the cheapest stuff. There was a little bit of improvement happening during the energy crisis, where the incentive for improving the energy efficiency was quite obvious. So there are a number of systems that were introduced to save energy. So that kicked it up a little bit. Still in the Swedish building code, there are no sensible specifications, and I think that's really what is stifling progress. Maybe you're better off in Canada, I don't know. Yes. Did you all hear what Professor De Silva said? Yeah. The question was that there is some criticism brought upon the control systems community that we try to solve the problems we can solve instead of the problems that need to be solved.
It's a slight paraphrase on what you said. You may recall here that on one of my slides, I had what I call, say, the gap between theory and practice. And I personally am a little bit worried about some of the things I'm seeing in universities. And I hope that there are enough deans around here that can hear this. I think that there is something not quite healthy about the promotion system in many universities. And I will illustrate what the situation... For example, if I was a young engineer coming out nowadays, coming to university, my situation would be the following. I have 3 years to prove my... If I get to work in North America, that was it. I have 3 years to prove myself. I've just done a dissertation. And I did this dissertation for a professor who never done anything really practical in his life. He was educated by a professor who looked exactly the same. He was a professor who spent... He was teaching engineering, but he was spending all his life inside the university. And the topic I did for my thesis was, so to say, what my... it was a problem for my grand professor's thesis that was left over from my professor, and then it was a little problem left over from him that I'm now trying to solve. So it's a sort of a third, fourth, fifth generation sub-problem. So I solve this now. And now my task is I have 3 years to prove myself. And what I have to do, I have to bring in money. I have to do good publications. I have to do service to the university. I have to do good teaching. Okay. So I know that in 3 years I have to have a reputable publication list. So what do I do? Well, I take my old thesis and then I write 6 papers from it. Not particularly interesting, but that's typically what happens. And then I take 3 other graduate students and I put them on some sub-problems on my thesis. So they write upon this. And then I try to get a research grant. And the only thing I knew about was this problem I was working with. So I write a research grant for that. I'm exaggerating now, but I think there's a certain truth for this. And I think you can do a few things. For example, if we do the promotion system to say like this, when we're going to evaluate people, let's only look at 3 papers. Let people submit 3 papers. And these papers we will read. I think that would be one way to increase the way we're doing quality. I think we should encourage the young people we have to look a little bit out to the real world and maybe have a system where if they are teaching engineers, of course, not all of them, but we should at least send some of them out to industry to see a little bit about the world that the students they are educating are going to work in. So may we see some changes in the promotion system that you'll be seeing in the future?
Any more questions?
Do we have some more questions?
If not, I would like to call on Dean Axel Meisen, one of our deans here at UBC, Dean of Applied Science.
You really set me up, didn't you? I'd like to blame it on the system with respect to promotion and tenure, but I can't. Very seriously, Professor Astrum has spearheaded, together with the Swedish Academy of Engineers, a very incisive study on the education of engineers. We have done something similar here in Canada under the auspices of the Canadian Council of Professional Engineers, the National Committee of Deans of Engineering, and most recently the Canadian Engineering Academy, and we all identified the problem that Professor Astrum just described. The question is not characterizing the problem, the question is really to find a way out of this problem and to find meaningful solutions and to translate those into reality when there are traditions in the university and in the professions. That could be the topic for another lecture, quite frankly. In a sense, it was an answer to the last question that was raised and the answer that Professor Astrum gave. Let me now turn to the other task that I was asked to do. And the main task is namely to thank Professor Astrum for for having given this lecture at the Vancouver Institute. When I was approached about this, and this is now some weeks ago, I was, of course, delighted because Professor Astrom is a world-renowned engineer, researcher, scientist, educator, and indeed administrator. And to listen to him speak is a privilege indeed for everybody, myself included. However, when I was given the title of his lecture, namely Black Boxes and White Noise, I did become a little bit concerned. I wasn't quite sure how to relate these topics to Professor Astrom's background. Upon some reflection, however, I think the meaning really became quite clear of this topic. As a scientist, for which he is well known, he would clarify and demystify the topics of white noise and black boxes. As an engineer, he would outline how these topics and related matters could be applied for useful purposes, which would serve the needs of society. And during his lecture, I think, Professor Astrom, you have succeeded admirably in demystifying in your role as a scientist and to have contributed as a creative engineer. However, also, like any true scientist and engineer, you have opened up new questions. Some of us will therefore go home, undoubtedly, wondering about other concepts, not white noise and black boxes, but probably the meaning of stochastic control or intelligent control, to name just two of them. What I did not realize at the time I was asked to express my thanks to you was that you are also a very fine historian who would give us a very good historical perspective of the development of automatic control. Thus, on behalf of the Vancouver Institute, its members, its friends, and its guests, I would like to thank you for having given us a most interesting lecture from the perspective of the inquisitive scientist, the creative engineer, the historian, and indeed the academic. Thank you very much, Professor Astrom.